Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Reporting from Burnaby, British Columbia, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. According to recent research conducted by Daniel Kerrigan, a postdoctorate fellow with the Department of Geography at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, the rate of personal use evictions has skyrocketed in recent years within numerous provinces throughout Canada, including British Columbia, Quebec, and Ontario. To learn more on why this is happening, CJSF was able to speak with Kerrigan and hear her speak on the reasons behind this rise in personal use evictions. The first question that we had to ask was, what are personal use evictions? Here's what Daniel Kerrigan had to say.
So like own use, personal use, landlord use, those are all kind of thrown around in the mix. And what it is it's a legal justification for eviction, which enables a non-corporate or individual landlord to move themselves or a family member into a tenant-occupied unit to terminate the existing rental contract. Mm-hmm. So in other words, like landlord or their close family usually, again, this like differs based on what jurisdiction you're looking at because all of the rules are sort of different, are able to terminate an existing lease to move themselves or a close family member into a rental unit that's occupied.
During our conversation with Daniel Kerrigan, we asked her to expand on some of her research findings regarding personal use evictions.
There's this really, really clear trend in Canada's three largest provinces that own use evictions are just absolutely skyrocketing, right? So in British Columbia and Quebec, own use evictions, the number of filings, and we're using own use eviction filings, which show landlord intent basically to evict. But basically what we've seen in this data is between 2019 and 2022 in Quebec and British Columbia, the number of own use evictions doubled, filings. And in Ontario, it doubled between 2018 and 2022.
Afterwards, we asked Kerrigan if her research yielded any possible reasons as to why this stark increase in personal use evictions is occurring.
What the initial evidence really points to is it's a lot of bad faith and fraudulent evictions. Mm-hmm. And it points to the fact that own use evictions right now, as they are in Ontario, as they are in British Columbia and Quebec, represent a relatively easy way for a landlord who's interested in getting higher new market rents to be able to evict their tenant. And so kind of like the things pointing to a lot of these being fraudulent is one of our big findings was that while they're skyrocketing in these provinces with strong rent control protections, they seem pretty steady in provinces where there's not a lot of tenant protections, which suggests that landlords aren't engaging in own use evictions because they don't need to, because they have other ways to kind of already get at this market rate rent.
This assertion stems from an aspect of Daniel Kerrigan's research where she interviewed various tenants throughout Canada that were experiencing evictions. Half of the interviewees included in the research were experiencing personal use evictions.
And about half of them overall were people who'd been own use evicted. You know, that was pretty steady in the three largest provinces, and it was way, 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 way less in New Brunswick, which again has very few rent control protections. And then, you know, you see articles from time to time as well, just in the media, documenting cases where it seems very much in bad faith. But from tenants, we heard, you know, systematic evictions. So people would see a landlord move themselves or their family members, or at least suggest that's what they were doing, into the units of a building with the longest standing tenant, and then the next longest standing tenant, and then the next, which is suggestive of going through the tenants paying the least rent and systematically kicking them out.
Lastly, we asked Kerrigan if her research provided any potential solutions for the rise of personal use evictions in provinces such as British Columbia. One of these potential solutions that she provided pertained to residential tenancy branches, or RTBs, implementing stricter regulations requiring landlords to provide evidence for personal use intent.
Before the landlord is allowed to send this notice themselves to the tenant, they have to go to the RTB and they have to have evidence. It's like, I need this apartment. I don't have alternatives. Like, this is something I actually require. Here's all the evidence I have. And so that would provide the advantage of then making it a lot easier for the RTB to check up on that, incentivizing tenants to challenge this. And it would also, I have a little bias here, but it would improve the quality of like the data as well, because you would actually see how many of these there are instead of just hoping like the tenant reports it so it gets contested and then it shows up in the filings data.
Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also listen to this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Hey Canada, we need to talk. Canadians want a healthy climate, but things keep getting worse. Horrendous wildfires, extreme heat, too much rain, or extended drought. You don't have to face this alone. With Citizens Climate Lobby Canada, you can do a lot. Working together, we can create lasting climate solutions. Visit citizensclimatelobby.ca and step into your power with Citizens Climate Lobby Canada.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
John Stark, a manager of social planning. I've been with the city for 18 years. I've been extensively involved with addressing homelessness, even though the work I deal with deals with a broad range of social issues. And over the past year and a half, being involved with the Crisis Response Pilot Project, I'm really just doing a lot of research with regards to placing it in a position where it can launch.
My name's Brad Davey. I'm the Deputy Fire Chief with New Westminster Fire and Rescue Services, but I've also been working with the pilot project for the last year and a half. I bring to this project my background of being a pharmacist with Fraser Health Authority and have some 30 years with that.
Great. Thanks again to both of you for being here. Can you give us a high-level overview of what is the Crisis Response Pilot Project?
The Crisis Response Pilot Project addresses the three crises of homelessness, mental health, and substance use. And we know with regards to the pandemic that all municipalities, with regards to these crises, there's been an increase. Between 2020 and 2023, based on our point-in-time homeless count, there was a 65% increase in homelessness in New Westminster. And our neighboring municipalities had similar or higher increases in homelessness. Combined with that, we have the opioid epidemic. And we also know with the pandemic that isolation became an issue. A number of faith-based and nonprofits closed their doors, just like civic facilities. And this really, for people who were dealing with mental health issues, there was definitely individuals who self-medicated to deal with this isolation and loneliness. So we saw these three crises definitely take hold. And as a municipality, we realized that the status quo couldn't continue, that if we really wanted to make progress, we couldn't just look at one crisis because we'd have limited effectiveness. We'd have to look at three because they're interrelated. We also recognized that these are senior government responsibilities, but we needed to do something in the interim as we work with the senior levels of government with regards to funding and resources. So there are three interdepartmental teams as part of the Crisis Response Pilot Project. The first is what we call a crisis response team, which is a non-clinical outreach team. And its purpose is to make connections, develop relations and trust. And that's done through trying to meet the needs of our unhoused population and those living with mental health and substance use issues. And this could be providing food, clothing items, taxi vouchers with regards to accessing services. And the whole idea for them is to make appropriate referrals to ensure that the people are getting the assistance they need. So they work with their faith-based nonprofit and provincial organizations and teams to address those issues. The other team we have is an operations support team. And this is really looking at the externalities related to the three crises. We know that businesses and residents have been impacted by these three crises. And we also recognize that when someone's impacted, they want to have a response to. So through bylaws, through fire, police, integrated services, and engineering operations and parks, they're trying to address the impacts of these three crises on residents and businesses. And we know if we can bring them on side and address their issues, they will be advocating with us with regards to trying to address these crises. And the third is what we're calling our policy and advocacy team. And this team is really important. This team is working with the senior levels of government around additional funding, resources, and services, addressing needs and gaps, and really communicating with that crisis response team and operations support team to get a sense as to what's happening on the ground and where we need to be advocating. And we have based this on extensive consultation and case study research. We looked at 9 municipalities, some of the best practices there. We met with several of the municipalities, and we did extensive consultation with health and ministry officials.
As you've described, there's a lot of moving parts there, and the whole point is that there are these three intersecting crises. How are you managing all of those different layers and their interactions?
You're right. We have a lot of moving parts, and that does make it a little bit complex, but it is a requirement. The reason being is that we need to have subject matter experts from each area in each field to address all the externalities. We're trying to address the concerns of not just those that are unsheltered, but also the businesses and the community in itself. And it is quite a complex part. John alluded to the fact how we had engaged quite a few people before we started the program. But along with that engagement, we've brought in a lot of different services to support us. And we're trying to bring a lot of different teams and support services and different agencies together to make sure that we can be effective. We realize that if we try to do this all ourselves, that we're not likely to be successful. So we do have the three different teams within the city, and those three teams are working well with the nonprofits, the faith-based organizations that are out there, provincial bodies, just about everything that you need so that you can make sure that we provide a holistic and wholesome approach to the three issues that we're trying to address and that it is fulsome.
You've both mentioned working with faith-based organizations, working with other community organizations and levels of government. I want to ask both, this crisis is not unique to New Westminster. It is something that is affecting municipalities across the country, around the continent and the world, but also particularly here in the Lower Mainland, all the other municipalities. So on the one hand, what is unique about the circumstances in New Westminster? And also, how do you work with or learn from or in other ways collaborate with other municipalities surrounding New Westminster?
The most unique part, I think, is our approach. One of the first things that we did is we looked at some of the literature that is out there. And as John has already said, we looked at all the other municipalities. We're not actually copying what anybody else has done. Instead, we're trying to cherry pick the approaches from the other different municipalities that are working. And then we have quite an active program involved to try to make sure that we engage everybody so that we can be an iterative in our approach and that we can adjust to identify any gap that's being missed or anything that we need to engage or to include anybody in that could be affected by these crises so that they have a voice to point us in the right direction if we need to improve anything. You know, we have some working groups involved with the program to inform the project, and we've set up some focus groups to try and inform the project to make sure that we don't miss anything and to make sure that we're including everybody that we should be including. I don't know if you want to add to that, John.
Like I stated, I think one of the strengths of this is not to look at the one crisis, because a lot of municipalities are looking at homelessness, but really to look at it in conjunction with the three, because we know that mental health and substance use are contributing factors to homelessness, and that these three crises are interrelated. So taking a more holistic approach and looking at them in combination, I think we'll have a lot more success. Just as some of the things we're looking at additional supportive housing in complex care beds, because we know that emergency shelters are not a long-term solution. And in a lot of cases, there's not even adequate emergency shelter capacity. So a big part of this is really compiling information, making a case that these are the needs and gaps. And this is how many supportive housing units we have, and working with the senior levels of government and trying to allay some of their concerns. Sometimes senior levels of government are concerned because there's opposition within communities with regard to supportive housing and other interventions. So by working with our business community and residents and addressing their needs, we're hoping to bring them on side and be part of that advocacy with regards to addressing these crises and looking at longer term solutions around supportive housing. We're looking at an inhalation component, because we know We do have an overdose prevention site, but it only addresses the needs of injection drug users and not those who inhale the drugs. And about 65 to 70% of people are inhaling their drugs now. So by having an inhalation component, that will bring people who are on a street inside. That also addresses business and resident concerns. So that's why we're trying to look at this. We need to be looking at this holistically, but also looking at the different sectors and how we can work together. We don't want a situation where it's happened in other municipalities where a supportive housing project is put forth and residents and businesses are actively campaigning against it. So we see that this is why we're taking such efforts to involve both businesses and residents, including on working groups.
Yeah, that scenario you laid out where a supportive housing project or another support is voted down by community members does seem to be a recurring story. What would you say to residents who are against this sort of thing or who might think that if you provide these extra resources, you might attract more unhoused people to come take advantage of such resources?
Well, I will say it's interesting. Our unhoused population is not as transient as people think. Every 3 years is a point in time homeless count. And based on that count, the most recent count, which was March 2023, 63% of the individuals had lived in New Westminster for over 1 year and 43% had lived in New Westminster for 6+ years. In a lot of cases, we also have evidence from other municipalities where there are very limited resources like Chilliwack, Abbotsford, Maple Ridge, where they have large homeless encampments. And very few services. And people have both informal and formal support networks, and they're less transient. And I think with regards to businesses, we have to realize if we're bringing people inside, whether that's a 24/7 emergency shelter or that supportive housing, those individuals are not sheltering in parks and business alcoves and doorways, open burning to keep warm or to cook, discarding belongings. They have access to toilets, which they may not have. So really, in a lot of ways, it's addressing some of the externalities or issues which they're concerned about. And I think we have to change the conversation around that. And part of that is through, that's why RIA is on board with regards to communication. It's trying to work with the community and bring them on side that not doing anything is not an option anymore, that we need to do something and that this will have positive impacts. It may take some time, but it will have positive impacts. And enforcement is also not a solution because it just moves the issue from one area to another. And the courts have stated that people are allowed to shelter overnight in public places. So we do have to look at longer term strategies.
I also wonder if either of you can touch on the importance of using trauma-informed, culturally sensitive principles to navigate these crises and how the group is going about that.
So I did reference the point in time homeless count, and what's interesting about that is based on that count, 3.1% of our population self-identifies Indigenous in New Westminster, but 43% of our unsheltered population self-identifies Indigenous in New Westminster. We also noticed a discrepancy between our unsheltered and our sheltered population, 12% sheltered self-identifies Indigenous versus 43% unsheltered, which raised questions for us is why we're individuals not seeking shelter. And we suspect that those shelters are not culturally appropriate or not meeting their needs. So we really need to rethink with regards to the facilities and services addressing their needs. The other thing we found out in that point in time homeless count that of those who are unhoused and self-identify as Indigenous, 58%, either they or a family member, had experienced residential schools. So there may be a mistrust of government-funded services and institutional-like settings. So sometimes when we think of shelters, sometimes we have rows of beds. And we have to really look at that and also with how we interact with individuals. And I'll turn that over to Brad to get a little bit more around our cultural, culturally appropriate response here.
Yeah, so it's both. It's making sure that you're culturally appropriate for the Indigenous, but also making sure that you're trauma-informed in your approach for anybody that's using substance use, whether they're Indigenous or not. Both of these populations have had a long history of mistrust in government agencies and maybe haven't necessarily always been treated the best way that they should be or a way that's appropriate for the conditions they're in. And maybe we haven't always been sensitive to what they've experienced, and even healthcare hasn't taken the best approaches. By trying to make sure that our staff and everybody that's engaged in these populations understand the trauma-informed approach and understand culturally appropriateness, we're hoping to build some connections that are meaningful and that can lead to patients opening up, you know, and building a trust in the supports that we're trying to offer them, or that we think and that they think are appropriate for them, and collaborate with them to build a patient-centered type approach that is consensual on both sides, where they have the trust in the supports that are being offered, so they will engage the supports in a meaningful way and hopefully end up with a better outcome.
And I just wanted to add there, we have engaged an Indigenous-owned and operated planning and facilitation company to inform our staff training around a crisis response team, and also to work with us as we work with the senior levels of government around new facilities, services, and supports to ensure that they're more culturally appropriate and they are meeting those needs. So that is a really important piece of the work. Also, from a staff perspective, learning about the impacts of colonialism in residential schools and ensuring that our staff, when we're having those interactions, are coming at it from a very compassionate point of view and a recognition of the trauma in which Indigenous people have experienced over the years.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the response or feedback has been from the community so far?
We've actually done more than one public engagement session. We've met on several occasions with the Downtown Residents Association, on several occasions with the Downtown Business Improvement Association. We had a joint session with the Downtown Business Improvement Association, the Chamber of Commerce. We've also reached out to faith-based and nonprofits. I will say with residents and businesses, there is kind of a wait and see, you know, wanting to see how, you know, how the situation will improve, and a lot of questions. But I will say, I think when the information is shared and they get a better understanding of the scope of the pilot and the fact that it's iterative, it is being independently evaluated and it's based on best practices, I think if we can demonstrate that we're not only meeting the needs of the unhoused and those living with mental health and substance use issues, but businesses and residents as to some of the impacts they're experiencing, I think we'll definitely, we'll get more buy-in for the pilot. And as noted, we're hoping that businesses and residents will help us advocate for needed services and supports, including supportive housing and an inhalation component. And part of that is being out in the community, answering questions, being accessible. I don't know, Brad, if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, I mean, we have had several engagement sessions, and obviously this topic can be quite controversial and divisive at times. But what we found is that by taking the time to engage, you know, businesses, the community, and everybody that's involved in a meaningful way, spending your time, making sure that you educate them and remove some of the misconceptions and make sure that they're working from good information, we found that we've had some good success in terms of maybe having a lot of people that maybe initially weren't aligned with what we were trying to do actually joining the project and trying to help us accomplish some common goals. That was part of the reason why we wanted to make sure that we had a communications person as a part of the team to help us get the message out. And we've had some good successes in terms of getting some of that message out to some of the people and building that team that is going to be quite large and collaborative towards working towards that common goal, which will help us with our advocacy that we spoke of earlier.
Are there any challenges that you foresee or roadblocks that you're working on overcoming at this point?
We're not expecting this to be an easy project. These crises, as you've said, are everywhere, and there's a lot of challenges associated with them. And each challenge, if you're going to go down to the individual level, can be very different than the next one. There's a lot of people that have feelings and opinions about all of these issues and how they should be resolved. So we are anticipating that it isn't going to be easy, but we do. We believe that we've pretty much put together a broad spectrum type approach to this that we can collaboratively come together and address everything. We have a lot of working groups, and you know, funding is always going to be a challenge. It's going to be hard to get the amount of funding that's going to be required to do some of these things. We are talking about making some infrastructure type investments. Getting teams to collaboratively work together is going to be a challenge. There's going to be quite a few issues that we're going to have to address, but we're prepared to do that. We're not coming in expecting that everything is just going to fall into place, which is why we designed the program to be iterative so that we can adapt as the environment changes and make sure that we're ready to address whatever comes next. John?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the sustainability is important. These types of changes, like when we're talking about supportive housing, this is a two-year pilot project. Some of these changes will take 3 to 5 years longer, really for substantive change to be seen. So we have to show in that two-year period that we are making progress, that plans are in place. We've heard from businesses and residents that they want a vision. You know, some, like for some businesses, they're looking at potentially extending their leases. They want to know what the plan is for the city. So we're looking at that. A big part of that is relationship building with the senior levels of government, either for funding this pilot beyond the 2 years or addressing the needs and gaps related to the three crises. And we've had a lot of success. I mean, an initial piece of success was human waste is an issue in our city. Businesses and residents raise it on a pretty well daily basis. It's an issue in all municipalities. But we worked with BC Housing. We now have a sanitation trailer, which offers toilets, sinks, and showers. It operates 24/7. It has attendant services, and BC Housing is covering the full cost of that. So that's been a plus, and we're starting to see some of the positive impacts with regards to a reduced amount of human waste and fewer complaints. And, you know, we're looking at the inhalation component. So some things we can move forward within the two-year period, and some are going to take longer, but we have to show the community what that plan is and what that vision and how it will impact them. And I think, you know, we are getting buy-in as we're sharing that vision, and also recognizing that it's iterative. Like we said, this is a pilot, and we're not going to wait until the end of the 2 years to make changes. If we see some not working or some needs to change, we'll do that right away.
Right, and you both touched on it a little bit, but I want to ask what your hopes are for the future of this project and program.
I'll talk it from a social planning perspective. Our social planning section is really about trying to assist vulnerable populations, give them a voice, address their needs. There are too many people right now who are unhoused, who are living with mental health and substance use issues. So my hope is that we do provide those facility services and supports so they can become either sheltered or housed, stabilize their lives, connect to services, and over a period of time, have the ability to be part of a community. And that's so important, that whole belonging, connecting. I've always heard that one of the, for someone who's unhoused, is that feeling of feeling invisible, you know, sitting on a sidewalk and people just walking by and not noticing them. I want to see these individuals feel part of a community, feel connected to a community, feel valued, and have the ability to make a contribution. And I also realize, being a social planner, because I'm going through two temporary use permits related to shelter proposals, is that the community better understands these issues, recognizes just how even childhood trauma can impact a person for the rest of their lives, and through providing supports and services that change can happen. So that is my hope.
And ideally, that when we design this model is the effects of this model also impact in a positive way the whole community, the businesses and the residents, such that some of the concerns that they express now or some of the issues that they have now, that they're not as prevalent or maybe don't even exist. But also to a point that this whole model could maybe be expanded and taken to other communities throughout the province or other communities that are dealing with this. We are taking a look at this and making sure that what we do is transferable. We're being evaluated by Douglas College, and Douglas College villages, that's one of the things they're going to be looking at, is how transferable are the solutions that we have to make sure that they aren't short-lived and limited. They can be used in other communities that have the same concerns.
You've mentioned the evaluation and the fact that the project is iterative. What are the next steps from here?
We've just recently launched, so it did take some time with regards to retaining new staff, onboarding those staff, and working with faith-based nonprofits and